Yeah. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Today, the U.S. Department of Energy stands at the forefront of helping the nation meet its energy, scientific, environmental, and national security goal, developing and deploying new energy technologies while reducing dependence on foreign energy sources. The success of meeting such a broad mission rests on the pursuit of an effective human capital approach and workforce strategy. What is the U.S. Department of Energy's human capital and workforce strategy? How is energy tackling the human capital challenges it's facing? And what is DOE doing to develop future leaders and pursue a strategic workforce planning approach? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Michael Caine, Chief Human Capital Officer within the U.S. Department of Energy. Welcome to the show, Mike. It's great to have you.
Nice to be here.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Barb Hudson. Barb, welcome. Always
Thank
nice
you.
To have you. Mike, before we delve into specific initiatives, I know folks are familiar with the Department of Energy, but could you give us an overview of its history, mission, and continued evolution?
The Department of Energy is one of the most diverse departments in the federal government. It spans the sciences from concept demonstration all the way through applied engineering in the areas of technology, in the areas of energy, and a little known fact, in national security. The department actually manages the nation's nuclear weapons stockpile. That's one of its largest missions.
So with that broad and complex set of missions, could you give us a sense of the department's scale of operations? Tell us about how it's organized, overall budget, number of FTEs, and geographical footprint?
The department is organized around mission areas. There are a number of undersecretaries, three to be specific, one for nuclear security, which takes the nuclear security mission for the weapons programs, non-proliferation worldwide, preventing the spread of nuclear materials, and then the environmental cleanup of the Cold War legacy. Then there's an energy portfolio, which deals with everything from fossil fuels and our management of those resources to our development of renewable technologies and more traditional energy support areas like electricity, electric transmission services, those things that we want to protect in the country and continue to advance. The third and the really most important area we have is the science portfolio. And that's where we look at science in the largest sense, new discoveries, those things that industry does not want to tackle. How do we bring the materials and technologies of tomorrow into the workplace today and make them available to the country?
And what size of what budget are we looking at for such a big?
$26.4 billion is the department's budget. There are 15,000 federal employees that work in the department. And then there are 93,000 contractors who actually manage the nation's national laboratories.
Would you tell us a little bit about your role as the Department of Energy's Chief Human Capital Officer? Specifically, you know, the roles, responsibilities, some of the duties that you perform, and how those efforts support the energy mission?
My job as the Chief Human Capital Officer is really to be the right hand to the senior leadership on how we acquire, retain, and actually deploy talent. So it's how we assure that the programs have the intellectual expertise they need to execute the mission. In the Energy Department, it's all about that expertise. We need highly specialized people, specialized nuclear engineers, specialized scientists, physicists who do the research work, physical scientists who deal with the material property itself, energy sciences, those types of arenas. So we're a very technical department when you look at how we're organized.
With that high level of technical expertise that you need, thinking about your duties and responsibilities, what are your top three challenges that you face in your role, and how have you sought to address those challenges?
One of the immediate challenges that we're facing in the Department of Energy is that, like most federal agencies, we've aged in place somewhat over time. We have a very mature workforce. And so succession planning, pathway, career development is very, very important to us right now. It's one of the top things on my list is to make sure that we have healthy staffing inside of those technical programs. And healthy staffing means we have an array of skill level from the very senior to the entry level. So that knowledge capture that's critical for the government to do its mission work is transferred quickly, consistently, and in fact, fully throughout the workforce. That's one major challenge. The second is dealing with the fact that we have a more mobile workforce today than we've ever had before. And we need to plan for that. We need to plan for telling employees where the next big science project is going to be. And it may not be in the laboratory they're working in today. It may be across the country. And giving them that insight and that information 5 to 6 years ahead of when that job's going to be available so they can prepare as individuals, training-wise, and then as people to move their family or move other things around in their life to accommodate the career mobility that they need. The final piece is one that I mentioned, and it's education and learning. And I'll differentiate learning from education. Education you can program. You can put courses out there. You can decide what you're going to make available. It's learning. It's that career pathing. What information do I need to do the job I have to do today? And what do I need for the next challenge? And how do I acquire that learning? How do I match formal education to job experience? Because when it comes down to it, these jobs are all about judgment, making decisions on behalf of the government with contractors, with laboratories, with international partners that are going to change the face of the country. And that's an important thing.
So speaking of career paths, could you describe your career path for our listeners? You know, how did you start your career and what brought you to this current leadership position?
Well, my career is a bit different than most. I actually started with the federal government a little over 30 years ago. I started working in the National Gallery of Art. And I was an exhibit specialist. I majored in art in college. And when I came in, I thought I was going to do art. Well, it turned out what I was going to do was manage contracts that helped build design, manage budgets that got the designs built that brought the shows in. And that started me on the path of program management and budget management. And I spent the next 16 years in the Defense Department after I left the National Gallery working in aviation programs. And I was a budget officer, and then I was a program manager, and that brought me back to the Energy Department. I was actually recruited to come back to work on trying to size the laboratory budgets and the offices that support them because I had some expertise in that area. That led me into the stand-up of the National Nuclear Security Administration, and that put me back in the HR business. And that's how Secretary Chu finally moved me. He said it was time for me to leave the comfort of that job and move over and contribute on a larger scale.
And it's quite the larger scale. I mean, with that kind of career path, I'm interested to understand from your perspective, what are some of the characteristics of an effective leader? And more particularly, who's influenced your leadership style and management approach?
Well, I think one of the things that makes a good leader is somebody who constantly puts themselves in a position of availability. I think you have to do that. You have to be available to hear many, many voices and be able to recognize the fact that many times you have to seek those voices out. They won't come to you on their own. So that's one thing I try to do. I also look for the fact that in different roles, you have different mentors. So you ask, who are the people who influenced me greatly? Bob Goodnight, the president of SAS, is an individual that I track real time. Why? Because when you look at what he's done retention-wise with a highly technical workforce, you have to say, boy, I'm impressed. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I try to do is look at what he does and try to see how I can fit that into our programs at Energy, our way of dealing with HR and energy. And he really looks at creating a work family and being respectful of the family balance that employees have, but making them understand that they are there to support each other. And he expects them to inquire about their work-life balance and to keep that in tow or in balance as they go through the day.
What is the U.S. Department of Energy's human capital and workforce strategy? We will ask Michael Caine, Chief Human Capital Officer within the U.S. Department of Energy, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What are the seven management imperatives all government executives need to know? How is DOD improving its business operations? What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextJet? How is New York City shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And what about power, security, and leadership in the 21st century? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Michael Caine, Chief Human Capital Officer within the U.S. Department of Energy. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Barb Hudson. So, Mike, the department is facing significant operational challenges over the coming years. Those challenges require a flexible and responsive human capital support system that makes people and relationships integral to the daily operations of the department. Could you give us a sense of the overall energy strategic plan regarding human capital? What are some of the goals and objectives of the plan, and how do they connect to the overall department plan?
I talked a little bit about the fact that we're struggling with the maturity of the workforce. One of the things you'll see in the strategic plan that we have is valuing the workforce and treating each individual as an asset. And that asset is tied back to what does the program need, at what skill level, and when. So how are we doing workforce planning, and how does that workforce planning reflect that learning environment that I talked about? One of the things we're doing in energy right now is we're focusing in on how to make sure we translate that senior level information down. Secretary's a big proponent of doing that. As he'll tell you, he was a college professor for 30 years. He knows something about communicating and teaching. We're now standing up a program where our senior leaders are going to be teaching. We have the best nuclear physicists. We have some of the best energy lawyers in the business. We have people who have been on the ground in Russia and in other areas of the world dealing with nuclear materials. Who better to teach us about that? Who better to set that perspective? And more importantly, that sets up a cultural change within the agency that aligns individuals and people, that improves communication. And so it's all linked back to mission area, mission focus, how we improve that communication throughout the complex. We're also working on the fact that you can't do that just in a localized environment. You have to do it in an electronic world because we're spread all over the country and, in fact, all over the globe. So one of the things we're driving towards is using technology, using electronic mentoring, using VTC types of applications, using shared classroom environments and MP3 downloads of these type of education sessions to link people up so that what we have is the ability for an entry-level employee somewhere out in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to get to me and to say, I'm trying to understand something about accepted service hiring, not general schedule hiring. Help me. And they can get that information from me directly, or they can get it from files where I've talked about it in other types of environments.
I mean, your strategy has to be based on a reaction to something, some challenges that you're facing. And I want to touch a little bit on the external and internal human capital environment and challenges you're facing, and could you highlight some of those for us?
Well, certainly externally, we're facing the same challenge that many other agencies are. When you start hiring in very specialized areas, it's sometimes difficult to find those people and to bring them in with the pay scales that the government has. We have a number of accepted service authorities that Congress has given to us. We also have some pay authorities that are unique. We have a pilot program in the National Nuclear Security Administration that actually deals with paying specialized engineers more money. It's a pay-for-performance plan. It's a five-year pilot. It's in year four, and it's working quite well. It is one of those items that deals with generational issues as well, because when you start taking away the normal government step increase profile, you start talking about pay on an individual basis. People want to know, what do I have to do? What is expected of me? And it drives those discussions in a very direct way. We're using that experience as we in the department get ready to enter into the government's GEAR program. That's the goals, engagement, accountability, and results that John Barry has been talking about, and we're one of the pilot agencies. We're looking at how we get people to communicate. Back to the fact that we have wide generation differences, we need to be talking more about what expectations are and making clear whether those expectations are being met, not just on the supervisory side, but on the employee side. When you bring in a new generation, thinks differently, learns differently, you have to adapt your systems, true, but you also have to adapt your language and your culture and the way that you integrate and talk about progression, talk about performance. And so we're focused on doing that through the GEAR project. Some of the things we're doing are driving metrics into the program review processes, starting to use, well, it's not just cost and schedule. Where's your staffing? How well prepared are they? How healthy is the office itself? Are they trained up? Are they working well together? Are there enough people? And putting that in the actual process of technical review. It is a component of program success. Let's make it one.
So you had mentioned earlier about the strategic workforce planning that you've been involved with and the management of that. We know it's critical for you to ensure that that's properly aligned and it's current and evolving with all of the strategies and missions within the Department of Energy. Could you tell us a little more about your efforts to improve the hiring process within the Department of Energy, and how is that in accordance with the priorities of the President's hiring reform initiatives?
Well, certainly that's an important initiative, and one of the big things is time. Time is a driver, and when you slow it down, you lose opportunity, and we know that. And that doesn't make any difference whether you're hiring somebody just out of college or, frankly, whether you're hiring an experienced physicist. It is time that either meets the individual's requirement for deciding they want the job, or it can be time that tells them, I don't really think they're interested in me. So time is a critical factor. We have been driving the time down. We were at about 164 days. Can you imagine that? 164 days to fill the average job. We've now got that down to about 93 days. We're not really focusing in the senior levels in the last piece of that, which is when do they actually come on board. We've kind of thrown that measurement out because for us, we're usually recruiting people who are actively engaged in the work in senior levels. And we want them to finish that work and leave where they are with some closure. So we tend not to look at that piece. But on the entry level, we're driving very hard to make sure we turn those announcements around as quickly as we can and that we drive to closure to the point that we're actually having employees try to reach out and talk to the individuals right after we get that announcement closed, right after we get the selection made, so that they get a letter asking them to accept, they get a call from somebody in their office. We're also getting ready to roll out, as many other agencies are, what I call e-onboarding, that starts to take us away from having you report on day one and do a what I call the blizzard of paperwork. Bring your ballpoint pen and get ready to have cramps. Do that all online before you get there. And turn the first 3 or 4 days worth of coming in the building into, let's talk about the mission. Let's talk about the people you work with. Let's talk about what it's like to be in this building. Let's get down to why you're here.
So given the complexities of the Department of Energy, how does your organization evaluate the HR field performance and drive best practices across that entire community? Specifically, what steps are you taking to ensure that policies and procedures are implemented and monitored across such a vast and complex organization?
We use a variety of tools. We do use audits. We do peer-related audits, and I think everybody does those. My own philosophy on audits is audits are really an opportunity for improvement. They're not something that we want people to fear in the HR community. We want them to say, okay, the audit gives us a chance to look at what we do very well and to let other people hear about that. It gives us an opportunity to look at what we don't do well and determine whether that's a local activity or whether indeed that's something that's systemic in the way that we approach HR management in general. And we need to invest more money in training, or we need to build better systems, or we need to change the procedures that we put in place. What we found so far is that when we approach it as being an audit, is there to tell us the quality of what we're delivering for the managers, for the frontline supervisors. When we look at an audit that way, we find ourselves saying, we can do better. And we do better because the audit points out to us where we're weak, not where we failed, where we're weak.
So developing future leaders is critical for a department with such an important mission as energy. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing to pursue succession planning and executive development? Basically, you know, what is the Department of Energy doing to ensure continuity of leadership through that planning and development?
We've got a number of both formal and informal programs. Some of our formal programs are actually targeted at the entry level. So we bring in people who have just come out of graduate school and they're on a fast-track program where they're exposed to many aspects in the department, not one program area, not one office, but a broader set of conditions and environments that they may work in. That's done purposely to give them a real operating environment portfolio, if you will, and at the same time put them in a position where they are able to understand the complexities involved in these different sites and the work they do and how they do it. That works to a degree, but it's not the only answer. Because if all I do is orient you to what the department does, you don't get the actual fundamental skill and experience that builds the judgment. So we're focused, as I talked earlier, about having younger leaders locked in with mentors and coaches. And we actually encourage our leadership cadre to have more than one mentee. So you may have somebody who is, I have mentees, for example, who are technical people, and I'm talking to them about how to manage people better. They may also have other individuals who are technical managers who sharpen their skills in how to assess technical progress and how to deal with technical issues in decision making. So we try to have a broad-based set of communicators who can help people grow in multiple directions. The other thing we're struggling with right now is, I talked about the complexities of the mission. How do you move people across those mission areas? Now think about that for a minute. Nuclear weapons and renewable energy technologies like solar, okay? Engineering, program management, finance, budget, but completely different philosophies and cultures. Our objective is to get those on a Z path, where as people come in, they move back and forth because they learn different skills and different types of leadership attributes in each one of those areas. And it's important to us that they have that, because in the end result, we have to come together as a department and we have to decide with the secretary what the priorities are and what the budget investments are going to be. And the more we understand about where programs are, the more we can work together to do that in a seamless manner.
It's that it's the benefits of the enterprise viewpoint, too, that you get from cross-training like that. The thing I want to switch focus on is the performance culture that you're pursuing within the department. And given the vast mission set that you have, how are you streamlining and consolidating your performance management system? And could you give us a sense of some of the success stories that you have in this area?
Well, I talked about one of them, the National Nuclear Security Administration's pay band system, which is a performance-based system, is working very well. It's encouraging broad communication. There is a lot more discussion around expectation and a much deeper appreciation for how work is prioritized and addressed in that system from what we can see today. As I said, it's a pilot, and we'll know in several years how it really matures as people move through the system. The second piece of that is we've gone to an electronic performance system. That speeds communication. It actually improves it. It's one thing if I'm sitting here putting it down on paper and I've got to call you in my office, but we're now finding you're on the road traveling. We need to get that appraisal in place. We can send it to you. You can send it back to us. We can have an electronic dialogue about it, and we can get it in place. Mm-hmm. Employees feel good about that. Supervisors feel good about that. HR people feel great about it because they've gotten everything in place. More importantly, there's not confusion. Because they can edit and have a dialogue online and go back and forth and make those changes, they do. They don't say, well, I've got it all nice within the lines, and so let's don't change it. We know what it means. They have that dialogue. And so that system is the basis for what we're using as we move in to that performance pilot. One of the other things we're doing in performance is we're forcing more conversations. So we're taking what we learned in the NNSA pilot, and we're moving that over. We're saying we're going to have more than the typical three conversations. I set it, I check it, I close it. We're going to have all discussions in between there that are progress reviews so that you know you're progressing well, or no, we need more attention here. Well, I think I'm doing it okay. Well, let's talk about why it's not now. Let's don't wait till we get down to the mid-year and say we're not there. That is going to help employees because it's going to give both sides a voice to say, you know what, I don't have the training I need, or I'm not getting the guidance I need. I'm not getting the help.
I was just wondering, given the size of the Department of Energy and the various mission sets, which you've done a wonderful job of articulating, what is the major challenge of fostering a performance culture in such a huge agency? And more particularly, how are you using sort of different technologies or social media to get that message out and to instill it?
Well, you hit it. Communication is the big piece. And if you look at the Department of Energy, one of the first things you see on the employee value surveys is we've got scores that are really worth watching from a management perspective in the area of communication. Employees are telling us there's not enough. There's so much going on here. There is so much happening. We're not getting everything we want. So what we've got to do is focus on how do we get that information out. Social media is one way to do it. The department has rolled out a program. You can go on site and you'll see it. And it tells the employees where everything is, what's going on. And it's everything from technical achievements to me singing Single Ladies at charity drives. So it's got something for everybody. And the bottom line is what we're seeing is employees are saying, okay, I'm able to read this, and now I'm able to go back and ask somebody, what is this? It's starting that two-way street. And that's really what the secretary wants to drive to, communication that is a two-way street, collaborative discussion that wells from not the top down, but from every direction. That kind of constant availability that I talked about when we first started.
In a sense, the size, the physical size of the department isn't really necessarily, when you go with that approach, it's not an impediment then.
No, it's not. And that's the beauty of technology. You can get online and see exactly what happened 2 hours ago. And when you're in California from Washington, that's a big deal.
What is the U.S. Department of Energy doing to develop future leaders and pursue a strategic workforce planning approach? We will ask Michael Caine, Chief Human Capital Officer within the U.S. Department of Energy, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen? How is the U.S. Department of Homeland Security turning its one DHS vision into a reality? What is New York City doing to shape a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And how is the DoD improving its business operations? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, DHS Undersecretary for Management Raphael Boris, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations Stephen Goldsmith, and Dave Winogren, Assistant Deputy Chief Management Officer at DoD. Professor Joseph Nye and General Anthony Zinni on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century, and seven management imperatives that government leaders should pursue to be successful in an era of fiscal constraint. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Michael Caine, Chief Human Capital Officer within the U.S. Department of Energy. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Barb Hudson. Mike, I want to turn our conversation around a little bit and talk about the role of the folks who work for you, the HR workforce itself. As you know, the federal human resources community is changing from sort of a transaction-based environment to what you've done in the previous segments, talk about the strategic and consultative role HR folks are taking. Would you tell us about that effort to transform human resources and the function of human resources in the department, and what are some of the benefits of doing this?
Well, some of the benefits are that you get at, when you get out of transactional environments, you can actually start to help look at a more long-term workforce solution. Having the HR people consulting with the managers themselves, having them understand some of the mission specifics, gives you the ability to help the managers look forward. It also gives you the ability to help the manager when they start looking at what are the critical attributes of that job? What do I really need? Marry that consultative service up with the learning community. Here's the demand you're going to have. Here's what you're going to need if we hire that way. It starts to create that seamless community that's about delivering not just an employee, but delivering an individual whose commitment and whose desires are all understood, recognized, and supported, not just by management, but by HR.
And it strikes me as if it's not an afterthought. It's actually built in. By taking that approach, you're actually building in a strategic view of the function.
That's right. And it's easier said than done. I mean, let's be direct. Still, the merit system, you know, for all the pride I have in it, it demands certain rigors and certain records and papers. And with staffing constraints where they are, it's difficult for most of us not to err more on that what I'll call process side. But the trick is to say to people, you have to step out of that. And what I'm engaged in right now with my own leadership team is, do we build the right career pathing for HR professionals? Are we doing that? Are we making sure that we don't just turn them into consultants, but we have them based and ready in the regulations, in the policy, in the actual practice? How solid is the foundation we've given them? Because if we haven't done that for them, then we're really putting them long-term at risk. We are not holding our responsibility for their ultimate career in our hands. We're just kind of leaving it on the table, is my view of it. So we're pushing internally to say, do we know what everybody's career path is? And do they know where those career paths in the map of life start and stop?
That's a good segue to the next one. So if we stay on this development theme, can you give us a little more insight into the key learning and development strategies? I think our leaders would be interested in hearing more about your learning management system. And how does that tie or link the career paths into the competencies that they'll be moving forward into?
Well, somewhat you're driven in the department by the fact that you do have all these diverse disciplines. So what we really have is more a university-based system. We have specialized training in many of the areas. We don't try to change that training. We try to get over the top of it, look at the structure of it, look at the quality of it, look at how that training is actually measured, the effectiveness of it, and then how can we network that training to other parts of the department. So you might have a nuclear engineering focus. You might also have a materials engineering focus that is in another program area but relies on training developed for a completely different group. We don't want to stop that. We want to encourage it. We want to make sure that it meets a standard structure, and if possible, we want it electronically loadable. But we also are embarking on that teach the teacher piece. So one of the things we're doing is bringing educational consultants in to help engineers, managers, people like me, build curriculum. I may have a lot of information, but I may not know how to deliver it. I may not know how to actively test during the class to make sure it's getting across. So we're marrying those experts up. That is feeding back into the electronic delivery of classes and the computer-based classes, and we're pushing that out across the department. Now, some of that's in its infancy. When you start talking about putting a lot of SESs up in front of things, I think we have almost 60 SESs now, senior executives, that are in the program teaching. Some of them teach at colleges and universities. They do that. So they are further along. Some of them are recognized national subject matter experts in very narrow fields. We need to help them. What we're doing is taking them and having them do that teaching. They teach a qualified group of people. We make sure those individuals understand it, and then they go back to their localities and teach it. So you can get the learning both ways. You can get what I call the straight information taught online or downloaded, or you can get a discussion-based, which is case-developed. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about the way we do this and why. Let's talk about this particular approach and what the pros and cons are to it. We're finding that to be a very ripe area with our workforce. And it's a little scary for people who say, okay, I'm going to come and I'll participate in the class. Now I'm going to go back and I'm going to subject myself to trying to proctor people through this after presenting the base information. But the sessions I've been involved in, I will tell you, you learn an awful lot because it's that peer-based discussion of my experience, my orientation, that lets you sharpen your own judgment and your own skill base.
Well, Mike, it's an interesting segue to understand what energy is doing around securing and retaining intellectual resources and knowledge. Could you give us a sense of DOE's knowledge management strategies and how they're doing this successfully?
Part of the strategy is based on the fact, recognize what you have and mine that information. Make it a recognizable effort that it's valued, and then focus on where the workforce actually is. So know where your senior talent is, know where the fabric of the workforce is strained. And strained, I mean you haven't been able to recruit in there, or it's a highly competitive market and you have a lot of turnover. That's one of the areas we focus on right away, is let's make sure that we have a lot of in-practice learning, a lot of case-based discussion, a lot of networking between senior level and junior level. That's one of the most valuable retention tools we've found, is I'm learning, I'm growing, my environment is changing, but I'm getting into areas that I never thought I would. So it's about giving them access to different project assignments and making sure you have a career map for where they're going. And it's about giving them the learning that forces them to say, what do I know about that? I would have never known this if I hadn't been put in this condition. But you have to have the leadership behind it to back them up. to help them feel secure.
How are you leveraging information technology to retain this knowledge management?
As I said, we're using e-mentoring a lot. We're also using VTC capabilities, and some of the things that are in their infancy are the MP3 player. I have this whole concept of my vision is you're going home from work at night. Better yet, you're coming into work in the morning and you check your BlackBerry. And the boss says, I want you to be in here and talk to me about XYZ. I want to get to the point where they can go in and say, okay, give me the 20-minute session on this. Give me the Cliff Note version. So they get enough to understand the subject. Then when they come out, they say, okay, now that I know what I got to do and I've got a couple of days, give me the resource of who does this, where they do it, who's the expert in the building, and they can reach out to them electronically and say, help me.
So the information technology systems are fundamental for executing in your human resources areas. What are some of the current systems that you're using? Because I know some things have kind of gotten outdated or end of life, and you're moving into this whole new mobile employee environment. So can you give us a little more on that?
Yeah, we're running a lot of applications right now, particularly in the learning environment on Plateau. I think a lot of government agencies are. We are pushing right now, and I don't think it's any secret, we've asked for bids. We want to push Plateau into the cloud. I really think the cloud is where we're going to make the difference. We have some technical information right now that's out there on the Enter system, which is already out in the cloud. And I was just on that the other day. As a matter of fact, I went in there and I found some contractor-related training on how you pressurize a house. And it's basically an avatar-based thing that tells people who do energy efficiency audits how to do it. And I was amazed at how quickly you could scroll down through that. I mean, if you weren't as clumsy as I was, you could probably carry your iPhone if you had to do that job and do it on site. Now, you think about that. That's for an installer. That's for somebody out doing energy audits to determine whether they've got things sealed up or not. Imagine if I could do that with a budget analyst who's trying to understand OMB exhibits instead of them having to go all the way down the hall and ask somebody who says, well, I think I got it here. Wait, well, my version is 3 months old. That's what we have to get to. That's the wave of the future. That's kind of where we want to drive to. What are the impediments to doing that? Some people would say it's money. I don't think it is. I really don't think it is. I think it's adopting a thought that says we're going to do this every way possible and accepting the fact that we can't have technology dictate to us. We're in an environment now where we have to make the assumption that we are going to leave work behind because technology is going to drive us there. And we just have to say, yes, we are going to have to reinvent this piece. Let's go do it.
Interesting. I want to switch gears a little bit, but it does dovetail with a lot of your conversation around the cloud and cybersecurity and securing data.
Yes.
An element of HR is to...
Tremendous problem.
And I was wondering what you folks are doing to create a culture of accountability and protection of personal sensitive information.
We're focusing on this two ways. The first way is you can't turn to the CIO and say, take care of all my cybersecurity issues. They can't. So we have it within HR and DOE. I have a cybersecurity specialist on staff. We actually have somebody there who looks at all our systems because they can help us understand what's changing in the world, where the CIO is going, and then help us navigate the world of what decision do we make about system compartmentalization? What do we make about protecting information in stored files or taking it completely offline or exporting it? Mm-hmm. And let's face it, we're all doing business in a world where that's happening. Our payroll systems are outsourced. We feed external information systems all the time. So we need to have the localized knowledge of where's the rest of the world around us, and that helps. The other things we've done is we've actually, within HR, put a restricted perimeter around it. So we have restricted access. Why did we do that? To remind everybody the information you have on your desk is about a person. It's personal. It's not there. And if we let everybody just walk in and out, they can look on your desk. Well, what that does is it reminds people, hey, the reason that we make them come through a door and we have people that don't just let them walk back is because this is important stuff. It works. It's simple, but it works. It starts telling people, protect this at all cost. Don't make sure it doesn't get out. Think about where your machines are at the end of the day. Think about what's left on your desk.
Mike, how in this era of fiscal constraint are you keeping your staff and the general staff within DOE sort of motivated and focused on the important mission that you have?
Well, I think one of the things about public servants is really focus on how they can deliver the job. You know, obviously, budget constraints do impact us. We're tightening our belt everywhere we can. But what I'm focused on with them are, here are the things we have to accomplish today. And then in the budget environment, let's look at the initiatives and decide what's the highest priority and then push that initiative in the budget process. So I actually think tighter budgets help us because they force us to get everybody's buy-in on what is the most important thing we need to do. The other motivational factor that I think comes into this is you can spend all your time looking at data, but it's about recognizing what people do. And we spend a lot of time in DOE from the deputy secretary and the secretary on down making sure that we individually talk to people about what they do and the value of it. And to me, that is the biggest smile you see on people's face is when somebody walks into their office and says, you know, you did a good thing. And they know for that individual to come all the way down and do that, it meant something, not just to that person, but to a lot of people. And that's the biggest motivator we have right now.
What does the future hold for strengthening human capital efforts within the U.S. Department of Energy? We will ask Michael Caine, Chief Human Capital Officer within the U.S. Department of Energy, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Each edition of the Business of Government magazine has as its focus the core mission of the IBM Center, connecting research to practice as a means to improve public management. We do this by bringing together insights and perspectives blended with an equal measure of practicality and reflection from an array of government leaders, public managers, thinkers, and practitioners. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. In an era of fiscal contraction, today's leaders face unique challenges that present many difficult choices. It is a period that, while imposing many constraints, simultaneously confers as many opportunities to make a difference, introduce new ways of managing, explore pragmatic approaches, and pursue management imperatives that help government leaders perform in an ever-challenging, complex environment. In our latest edition, we bring you conversations with FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, outlining the Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen. Raphael Boris, DHS Undersecretary for Management, discusses how the department is turning its one DHS vision into a reality. Stephen Goldsmith, Deputy Mayor for Operations for the City of New York, discusses how the city is shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and efficient. We offer perspectives on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century from Professor Joseph S. Nye Jr. and General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command. Our forum presents seven management imperatives that government leaders must pursue to be successful in this new environment. All of this and so much more in the Spring-Summer 2011 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Michael Caine, Chief Human Capital Officer within the U.S. Department of Energy. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Barb Hudson. Mike, I talked to many of my guests about the use of collaboration and partnerships among agencies, branches of government in the public sector, private sector. How are you leveraging partnerships and utilizing collaboration to improve operations and results?
Well, I'm pushing, and everybody who works in HR will tell you sometimes they get tired of it. I volunteer us for almost everything the Chico Council is doing. The best way to learn, the best way to change is to get involved with other people who are doing it well or people who are trying to do something that may not work as well as you think, but we learn from it. And That, to me, is a value to the HR community, not just to the department, because what we're doing is networking professionals, and they're learning from each other, and they're growing and getting exposed. That is important because they bring change back into the building. They bring a questioning environment. They are the voice I want to hear. I want to hear every voice. I can't react to every voice, but I've got to be able to hear them because they inform improvement. There's no way around it.
Mike, you just mentioned the Chico Council, and I'd be remiss in not asking you. Could you give us a sense of what the Chief Human Capital Council is?
Well, it's a collection of all of the Chief Human Capital Officers from the cabinet agencies, and they come together to deal with issues that affect the federal workforce and affect the civil service across the broad spectrum of government. It's chaired jointly by John Barry and by Jeff Zients. Well, Jeff has now moved up, so his replacement will chair it. But they really focus on how can we make federal employment stronger, better.
You had mentioned the annual employee surveys, and we know that the employees' feedback can be a valuable tool to understand your work environment. Can you elaborate a bit on the Best Places to Work initiative and the survey that you do annually? And then, in addition, can you give us any insights into how you use that information that you gain from the surveys?
The surveys are very valuable tools because they tell you what the workforce is feeling. They don't necessarily tell you in specific detail what you need to work on, but they give you the focus of where you need to look for improvement, where you're not meeting everybody's needs and expectations. I think one of the values of Best Places to Work is what it does is take a subset out of that large employee value survey and start to say, this is what really sets agencies apart in terms of people wanting to be there, wanting to work there. For energy, those results are something we pay a lot of attention to. So when you think about it, it's one point on the curve, but it's an important part. That survey really gets at leadership and leadership attributes, the ability to teamwork, and diversity. It focuses on those types of things. Yes, it tells you about how they feel about pay and performance. But when I look at that, I kind of see that level. It kind of follows government-wide trends. So I look at what's different in the department, what's rising and falling. What I consistently see in ours, for example, I'll put myself on report, is I see first-line supervisors, the employees in DOE, have an inordinately high opinion of their first- and second-level supervisors, that they value them, that they provide for them, that they protect them, that they know the value of the work they do, that they manage them. When you look at the leadership scores, they say, leadership, okay, now who's that, okay? That's people like me. You know, you guys are not communicating well, where you're not integrating well, all right? You're in your silos of excellence, and you need to do a better job because we're not perceiving that you value everything we're doing. You're not hearing us. There's not a two-way street in communication. So we use those tools to say, all right, how do we adjust our performance? How do we adjust what we value in senior leadership? How do we communicate with employees? And what are we tracking? What are we looking at as operational measures that will tell us whether we're really getting at that? So we've used those to begin focusing on how much money is invested in training, how much is invested in travel, how much is in support service, what are we spending on modular furniture and space changes. It drives those considerations if you take it in the broadest term, which is what you've got to do.
So now if I can ask you to get your crystal ball out and let's transition more to the future. What's your sense on some of the key workforce and human capital issues that will affect not just DOE but government-wide over the next couple of years?
Certainly when I look at it, I am not going to tell you pay is going to be one of them. I think that would, you know, everybody could say that, and no matter where you worked, government or not. But I think one of the things that's going to drive it is the state of mobility in the workforce, teleworking and telecommuting. It's here, and we have